But when I do get a new schedule for Mr. McCoy, I am kind of excited. I flip through it, see who might be sick and traveling to give me an opportunity to give a sermon. And when I see my name down in the future sometime, I start thinking about what topic might be appropriate. What is something that I know anything about? And more often than not, I seem to drift back to the Ten Commandments. Besides being a foundational bedrock section of Scripture, these 10 simple statements or instructions or commandments are so multifaceted, so complex, that you could spend a lifetime going through each and every one of them, getting deeper and deeper, like peeling the layers off of an onion. Today, I'd like to draw down on just one of these commandments, but before we get started, I'd like us just to kind of warm up our brains first. It's a hot day outside, you've been sitting for a little bit, so I thought maybe we would just go, without peeking, mind you, and name the Ten Commandments. Now, you can kind of murmur it under your breath, so that way if you make a mistake, you can cough and play it off or something. But let's go through it here. Commandment number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Number two, you shall not make any idols or graven images. Three, do not take God's name in vain. You know these, right? Four, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. Five, honor your father and mother. Six, you shall not kill. Seven, do not commit adultery. Then what? What do we have? You shall not steal. We're almost there. Then you shall not lie. And then number 10, you shall not covet. That's not bad. I think we got an A for remembering them and maybe a C minus for participation. But wait a second. One of those isn't exactly right. One of those commandments that we said wasn't worded exactly the same back in the Old Testament. Anyone have a guess to which one it is? Because it doesn't matter. The test is over. Let's head back to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19, and we're going to investigate. I know the commandments are in chapter 20, of course, but we're going to pick it up a little bit earlier. Exodus chapter 19, we're going to start in verse 1 to get the context. And then we'll jump right to the commandments. Now, we'll have to remember the scene here, the nation of Israel. They had just left the land of Egypt. It was only 3 months ago. A land that they had known only as slaves and under great oppression. And they were led out with great signs and wonders as God led them out of bondage, out of that environment, through the Red Sea, all the way here to Mount Sinai. So let's pick it up in verse 1 of Exodus chapter 19. In the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Sinai, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai, for they had departed from Rephidim and come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain, and Moses went up to God, and the Lord said to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." So this was not because the Israelites needed a reminder about what they had just come from or what their condition was just a short time ago, but God now begins to formally lay out the groundwork of their relationship going forward. This was to be the contract of sorts between God and this fledgling nation. Verse 5. "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all the words which the Lord had commanded them. Then all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. Okay, so they've agreed to follow God, but now we get kind of to the nitty-gritty, all the details, the formal part of this relationship. And part of this relationship, that covenant, includes these Ten Commandments. Let's pick it up in the next chapter, Exodus chapter 20. We'll start in verse 1. Exodus 20, verse 1. "And the Lord spoke all these things, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth below, or that is in the water under the earth." So I think we got these first two. Dropping down to verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Dropping down to verse 12, honor your father and mother. So all these we mentioned at the start. Verse 13, you shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not lie. Oh, there it is right there. The ninth commandment is not quite right. In Exodus 20, verse 16, it says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This is where I want to spend the balance of my time today, because when we read this commandment, it's easy to think, well, maybe this is just kind of old-timey language here. I checked a dozen or so translations, and they're all pretty similar in their wording. But even so, it's easy to think that this commandment is really just talking about lying. In fact, it's almost universally simplified to thou shalt not lie or you shall not lie. However, the wording and the language used here does have a specific application and a meaning to the Israelites when it was given to them back at Mount Sinai. And that meaning was not just simply do not lie. Let's talk about this today. Let's investigate it together, and in doing so, I have a couple of points for us to cover. And I wouldn't be lying to you if I said that I hope you find them interesting. Point number one is, what is the concept of bearing a false witness? What is the concept of bearing a false witness? Point number two, how is bearing a false witness and lying different things? How is bearing a false witness and lying different things? Point number three, how can we apply this commandment in our modern lives? How can we apply this commandment in our modern lives? Point number one, what is the concept of bearing a false witness? What did it mean to bear false witness? A false witness of what? To whom? When? Well, one of the interesting differences about the nation of Israel, especially before the time of the kings, was how different the top end of their government functioned. If you look at our government system today, we have three branches. We have the executive branch, which runs the operations of the government. We have the judicial branch, which interprets the laws within the framework of the Constitution. We have the legislative branch, which does nothing whatsoever. No, they write the laws, of course. But this obviously was not the framework of ancient civilizations. Usually they had a king or a ruler, and he functioned in a way in all three areas. So he made the rules, he executed the rules. Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace? Or Daniel in the lion's den? Or Esther and King Azarias? All those stories involved a king making a rash decision, forming an entirely new law, and immediately putting it into execution. For the Israelites, that's not how this worked. God gave them their laws, and they were just to enforce it and judge between civil disputes. It's a different concept than most of their neighbors had. And some scholars assert that ancient Israel was the first nation ever to operate in this way. And for it to work, the nation needed three things. First, it needed to know God's laws, of course. Second, it needed righteous judges. And third, it needed honest witnesses to supply the facts to the judges. Over time, all three of these broke down in Israel and Judah, and the nation moved away from God into idolatry and away from his laws. The judges started to show partiality, favoritism. They became corrupt. The integrity of the people came to a point where their witnesses couldn't be trusted anymore. They took bribes. And not uncommonly, when you read through the minor prophets of God explaining the reason for his upcoming punishment and the fall of Israel and Judah, all three of these themes are often interwoven together. Let's go to Micah chapter 3 and verse 8. Micah chapter 3 and verse 8. Micah chapter 3, again, picking up in verse 8. It says, but truly I am full of power by the Spirit of the Lord and of justice and might to declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. So again, here is an explanation of what's going wrong in the time of Micah, which is to say, almost everything at this point. Verse 9, now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert all equity, who build up Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with iniquity, Her heads judge for a bribe. Her priests teach for pay. And her prophets divide for money, yet they lean on the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed like a field. Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountains of the temple like bare hills of the forest. The people were dishonest, the judges were corrupt, and the law no longer had any standing. These attributes were among the reason why God allowed them to be taken into captivity and for their land to be destroyed. But it wasn't supposed to be like this. It wasn't designed to be like this. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 18. Exodus chapter 18. And in a way, this is the formation of the civil structure of judges that the context of which the ninth commandment fits into. We're going to go back and pick up the story in verse 13 of Exodus chapter 18. In this chapter, we get Jethro, who's Moses' father-in-law, coming to visit. And he arrives with Moses' wife and two sons, and he brings them before Moses. They exchange pleasantries. They talk about how their life is going. And then we're going to pick up the story in verse 13, which is the morning after Jethro arrives, and Moses starts to go about his regular daily routine. Exodus chapter 18, again picking up in verse 13. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So Moses here was out in this huge nation here, responsible for solving all their disputes. Verse 14. So when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people have come to me to inquire of God, and when they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." So remember, this is before Mount Sinai, before the full explanation of God's laws and statutes were formally expounded for all Israel to hear. Verse 17, so Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out. For this thing is too much for you, and you are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen to my voice, and I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God." So that part was going to remain. Moses was still going to be the intercessor here to intercede between the people and take the most difficult cases for resolution. Verse 20, "And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of ten. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they shall judge, they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you that they will bear the burden with you. And if you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure. And all this people will go to their place in peace." So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he said. So this was the start of the civil structure that really comes into play here for the ninth commandment, because this provided the means for them to settle disputes, both of a civil nature, like my neighbor borrowed an ox and it died, and a criminal stature, like my neighbor became angry and killed my ox. Whatever the case was, it was brought before this type of judgment structure. The judges then weighed the evidence, applying God's principles and statutes, and rendered a verdict. Obviously, having a witness to corroborate your case was very important, if not critical. Let's notice the concept here in Deuteronomy chapter 19. Skip to Deuteronomy chapter 19. We'll read verses 15 through 21. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15. "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established." That verse is quoted several times in the New Testament. "If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, Then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who serve in those days, and the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, that's the exact ninth commandment there, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. And you shall put away the evil from among you. And those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. Remember, this is in the context of a false witness. Your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Witnesses of all kinds were treated with great gravity. You'll remember that in capital cases, the witnesses were charged with throwing the first stone, right? So they initiated the punishment. As a result, false witnesses of any kind could not be tolerated. And if they were discovered, then they would have the full punishment laid out upon them. The Encyclopedia Judaica has quite a lengthy section of the civil courts throughout the history of the nation of Israel, both as outlined in the Bible and as extrapolated throughout the generations of use and practice. For example, they have rules about when cases could be heard, who can bring a case before a judge, what they wear, who can sit, etc., etc. But one thing that remained consistent throughout generations of Jewish law is the importance of honest witnesses. I'd like to read this quote from the Encyclopedia that I found interesting, and that before a criminal trial, since the stakes were so high, they cautioned each witness that they were going to be interrogated, they were going to be cross-referenced, and then they gave them this warning, quote, "If you are going to tell us anything which you only believe or opine, or your opinion, or anything that you may have heard from another person, however trustworthy he may seem to you, or anything you know from rumors, or if you're not aware that this court is going to examine you by probing cross-examination, then you had better know that a criminal trial is not like a civil trial. In a criminal case, his blood and the blood of his children will be on him until the end of the world." Dropping down here. "Therefore, can each and every one say, 'It is for me that the world was created,' and do not say, 'Why should we bring this calamity upon ourselves?' For it is written, 'Whoever is able to testify from what he has seen or known and does not do so, he will be punished.' Nor may you say, 'It is more convenient for us to incur punishment for our silence than to bring about ourselves the blood of the criminal. For it is written, there is great rejoicing when the wicked perish.'" In other words, carefully consider your actions here. The results of your testimony and your witness are on your head, and it is not something that you should take lightly. This civil court system was to play an important part of the nation in regulating it. It was really the backbone of the nation, and when it was abused, it caused all sorts of problems. And unlike contemporary civilizations at that time, even the kings and queens of Israel were not above this court system. And truly evil kings and queens, they sought to pervert the court versus to override it. Let's notice in 1 Kings chapter 21 something. 1 Kings chapter 21. 1 Kings chapter 21, we're going to pick it up in the first verse. 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 1. "And it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard which was in Jezreel next to the palace of Ahab the king of Samaria. So Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, 'Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near next to my house, and for it I will give you a vineyard better than it. Or if it seems good to you, I will give you its worth in money.' But Naboth said to Ahab, 'The Lord forbid that I shall give my inheritance of my fathers to you.'" Ahab wanted something. He was the king, but he couldn't have it. And he starts to pout. And Jezebel knows that they can't just take it. So how does this evil queen get her way? Well, she perverts the court system with false witnesses. Let's drop down to verse 8. "Then she," that's Jezebel, "wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who were dwelling in the city with Naboth. She wrote in the letters saying, 'Proclaim a fast and seat Naboth with high honor among the people, and seat two men. Remember, you had to have two or three witnesses. Two men, scoundrels, before him to bear witness against him, saying, you have blasphemed God and the king. Only the first part was a capital punishment. Then take him out and stone him that he may die. So that's exactly what they did. They had multiple people that came forth as false witnesses and accused him of a capital crime so that he was executed. This really is a textbook case of breaking the ninth commandment exactly as it was written. For even more minor matters, if someone were to bear false witness during one of these judgments, it could still cause harm to the other party. Oftentimes, it would harm them on multiple levels. Yes, they might have to pay some sort of restitution, but it would also cause great harm to their reputation. And it's not like they could just pick up and move to another state. The result of a false testimony would have lasting effects. Two proverbs I'd like to bring out to help demonstrate the mindset and how damaging this could be. Proverbs chapter 24, verse 28. Proverbs chapter 24, verses 28 and 29. It says, do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause. For would you deceive him with your lips? Do not say, I will do to him just as he has done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. This is just dripping with vengeance, isn't it? It shows where the mindset often is with this type of sin. One other proverb, just one chapter over, highlights it in kind of a really interesting way. Proverbs chapter 25, verse 18. Just this one verse here. Proverbs chapter 25, verse 18. Says, a man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a club. Some translations have a maul. Is like a club, a sword, and a sharp arrow. This, I think, is so easy to read over in Proverbs because it's just one little saying in the midst of a huge block. But it's actually saying something very insightful here. Why those three specific attributes? A club, a sword, and a sharp arrow. Well, all three weapons are used in battle with specific purposes. A club or a maul is to smash something and to completely obliterate it. Basically, it's just to crush it. A sword is used to kill within close quarters. And then an arrow is used to kill at a distance. It's a metaphor describing the ability of a false witness to destroy not only a person's reputation, but their entire livelihoods, their estates, their families, anything else they hold dear. The combination of these three weapons in war are used to comprehensively destroy an enemy without escape. A false witness had the power to do someone to their neighbor as well. Well, we talked about the meaning behind this commandment, but the obvious question is covered here in point number two. How is lying different than bearing false witness? Is it different? Or are they two separate terms to describe the same principle? Because you do kind of have to wonder a little bit why the commandment was worded this way. It seems like how it's worded now is even just a little bit more restrictive than if God was to say, do not lie, or always be honest. And to be sure, this commandment is expounded upon, like all the commandments throughout the Bible, to have a lot of extra attributes and applications. And without a doubt, lying and bearing false witness are certainly related. In Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19, God lays out some attributes that he truly despises. And notice how he links together false witnesses and lying. Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19. It says, these six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift and running to evil. Verse 19, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. A false witness who speaks lies. That's one of the great abominations to God. And those certainly are most often joined at the hip. But even so, they are not synonymous terms. Not all lying is a false witness. For example, you could lie to yourself. You could lie to God. Nor are all false witnesses necessarily lying. For example, you are called a false witness if you do know the truth and don't present it. Or you could say something entirely truthful that you know will be taken out of context. Let's look at an interesting example in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26. This is in a section at the start of Jesus' trial and eventual crucifixion. Judas has already betrayed Jesus at this point. He's captured. He's been taken before the Sanhedrin, which, of course, is another courtroom-type setting. We're going to pick it up in verse 57 of Matthew chapter 26, verses 57. Matthew 26, 57. And those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Now, I want to pause here just for a second, because to me, this is extremely bizarre. Because you'll have to remember, this is right after Passover, right at the start of the Holy Day season. And maybe, just maybe, the leaders could justify in their own mind that their attempt to kill Jesus Christ was not violating the sixth commandment. Maybe. Maybe they were thinking it was for the good of the nation or some other justification. I don't know. But there is no way that they could justify this behavior of trying to find false witnesses. This is exactly breaking the ninth commandment. Not the intent, not the spirit of the law, but the literal commandment as it was written. Verse 60. But found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days." Well, this wasn't an outright lie. It's true that this wasn't exactly what Jesus Christ said. You can find it in Mark 14. But what Christ actually said was, "I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." So it is different, but it's not wildly inaccurate. And moreover, Jesus Christ made that comment years earlier. And even at that time, people assumed that he was talking about the physical temple, not his body. As a result, it's entirely possible that these false witnesses were saying something that they believed to be true. Now, the Bible doesn't record everything that they said, so we don't know the whole story. They could have been lying their faces off the whole time, and this is the only allegation recorded. But what we do have written here in this instance is not a bold-faced lie. And the same sort of thing happened with Stephen as he was being martyred. They went out of their way to find false witnesses, and when they finally got someone to agree, it was kind of not really an actual lie. Maybe something taken out of context and slightly reworded. And that shows one of the biggest differences between a lie and bearing false witness comes down to intent. A false witness has the intent to harm someone else in some way. An example of Christ's accusers and Stephen's accusers, whether it was a bold-faced lie or something that they hoped to be taken out of context, the fact is that they meant harm. This is what the commandment was addressing, and this was exactly what the people were doing. They were bearing a false witness to do harm. Christians are called to be honest, to speak the truth, to have integrity. They are also not to be false witnesses with the intent to harm someone else. But if we stick to the commandment as merely causing harm to someone in a courtroom or a judgment setting, then you might wonder, how can we apply this perspective in our modern lives? And that leads us here to our last point. How can not bearing a false witness be applied in our modern lives? How can not bearing false witness be applied in our modern lives? You know, you may very well be called upon and compelled to go to a courtroom one day to give your account and bear witness to a series of events. Years and years ago, my wife had a scenario where this was a possibility. In this instance, there was an altercation outside of our apartment window. The details were a little fuzzy, but apparently one individual was beaten and the other one threatened to go get his gun and to take action. And for those of you that come over to our house, be assured this is far away from where we live now. As long as you lock your car and run fast to our front door, you should be fine. But Sarah was a witness, a partial one, to the series of events that surrounded that altercation. And while I was blissfully sleeping, Sarah was noticing what was going on. She observed it, and then she called the police. She could have been given a subpoena, called into court, and asked for her testimony about what she saw and experienced. But that's unlikely to happen to most of us. You'll probably go your whole life without having to go into a courtroom or a place of judgment and act as a witness. But that certainly doesn't mean that this commandment does not apply to us. You can bear a false witness against your neighbor in a spiritual sense as well. Maybe a better way to phrase this question is, does your life uphold this commandment? Does your life uphold this commandment? What does our life, and your life, and my life, what does it bear witness of? Let's turn back to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3, we're going to pick one verse out here and expand on it a little bit more. It's just one verse here in the middle of the letters to the seven churches. Revelation chapter 3, we're going to start in verse 14. We're going to read just 14 and 15. And we get here to the letter to the church of the Laodicean. And we're not going to focus on the letter, actually, but rather the description of Christ. Revelation chapter 3, starting in verse 14. And to the angel of the church of the Laodicean write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation. I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were cold nor hot. Jesus Christ is referred to as the Amen, the faithful, and notice, the true witness. The true witness is an interesting term. That word translated witness here is martus, and it literally is a witness within a judicial setting. It's also used figuratively as a record or an eyewitness. You can just jot this down, but in Matthew chapter 18, we get the same word, and it's talking about dealing with a sinning brother and going to him. And in verse 16 of Matthew 18, it says, but if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, that's the same word, every word may be established. That's the same word used in Revelation and in Matthew. And it's the concept that a witness are an independent, true, and faithful representation of what was happening. They accurately reflected a situation or principle. But this word is also translated also as martyr, which brings out another interesting facet. When you think of a witness, we're actually usually thinking of it as a noun, as in this person is a witness, they observed something. Or perhaps we think of it like a verb, they witnessed something take place, they beheld it. But the word is also used as an adjective, meaning to reflect the qualities of something else. If someone were to say, that person is a witness to the powers of diet and exercise, you would know that they're slim, they're fit, they're in good shape, and that person characterizes the positive qualities of diet and exercise. Let's back up and get one other example of what I mean here in Revelation chapter 2, starting in verse 12. Revelation chapter 2, starting in verse 12. It says, and to the angel of the church at Pergamos write, these things says he who has a sharp two-edged sword. Verse 13, I know your works, where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days when Antiochus, my faithful martyr, that's that same word, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Antiochus was a faithful martyr. That was a characteristic describing him, along with holding fast to Jesus Christ, not denying his faith. Jesus Christ said that he knew their works. In other words, they were a true witness to God's way of life, reflecting those qualities. Further down in Revelation chapter 20, let's pick up a few verses in Revelation chapter 20. We're going to start in verse 1. Revelation chapter 20, we're going to start in verse 1. Chapter 20, verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up, and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. So we know the timeline and the context that these verses are talking about. Verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast nor his image, had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Well, this was not just a single one-time test. There, when someone asked them about God and they said, yes, I know him and I believe in him, and they passed the test and they were approved. The witness to Jesus Christ and for the word of God is a report, it's a testimony, it's a record of their character to see if they accurately reflect God and his way of life. Are we true witnesses? Do we reflect God and his way of life through our actions, through our behaviors, and through our lifestyle? If we are called before the spiritual court to give account, will we be discarded as a false witness or upheld as a true one? Let's look at this from a practical point of view. What does this mean for us right now? 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. We're going to pick it up in verse 1. 1 Peter chapter 2. It says, therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking. How many of these characteristics are of a false witness? As newborn babies, desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. Now, why are we to put away these things and reflect on the nature of God within our own lives? Why? Why do we do that? Drop down to verse 9. 2 Peter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshy lust, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works that they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. You might be the only exposure someone has to God's way of life until his day of visitation. And when that time comes and you are revealed to them, what would their reaction be like? Mike, this guy's kind of a jerk. Or maybe even worse, they could say, Mike, he acted just like one of us. I didn't notice anything different about him. Or will they better understand God's way of life through his and through our example? Saying something like, I understand now how this is supposed to look. I remember his example was different. His life reflected something different. And now I understand why. If we are a true witness to God's way of life, then we can fulfill these verses. We have to reflect those characteristics. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16, we get a very familiar section of scripture. You probably don't even have to turn there because you have it memorized. But let's look at it from this angle. Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16 says, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, that it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. In this example, the city is already built. The lamp is already lit, but what do you do with it? If you are a Christian within your mind only, then you are a light under a basket. You cannot function as a witness of God's way of life, and others cannot see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. All mankind will be held to a standard that God outlines. Does the way we live our life bear false witness to Jesus Christ and his example, or a true witness to God and his way of life? Well, in conclusion, the Olympics are tonight, so I don't want to keep you here too long. In conclusion, false witnesses can have an incredibly damaging impact on civil society. I came across one story, and it was in 2004. Yuan Johnson was acquitted of charges that he murdered a rival gang member. He was arrested way back in 1998 and charged with this crime. The bulk of the case, though, however, rested on three eyewitnesses' accounts, and all three of them pointed to Mr. Johnson as the culprit. He was convicted and sentenced to jail at just 19 years old. Unfortunately, after 11 and a half years, it was determined that those eyewitnesses were actually false witnesses. They were coerced into their testimony, and they gave it falsely, two of them to specifically remove the blame off themselves and pin it on him. When this was discovered, Mr. Johnson was acquitted, and he was given a $21 million settlement by the city of Chicago, which was the largest of his time. But then again, he did spend all that time in jail. This is a false witness within a legal framework, and it cost someone dearly. God's commandment does address this directly. There's no question about that. But like all of his commandments, its meaning is expanded and enhanced and evolves a great deal more. Thousands of years after this command was given on Mount Sinai, Jesus Christ explained that all the commandments can be summed up by loving God and loving your neighbor. How do you do that? Well, each commandment, including the ninth, gives you the practical roadmap. The ninth commandment is specifically worded to prevent false witnesses causing grave and sometimes permanent damage to the reputation and the livelihood of another individual. The integrity of the judges, the knowledge of the commandments and the statutes of God, and the honesty of the witnesses were all integral parts of the civil structure for the nation of Israel to be successful. As a result, comparatively harsh punishment was metered out on those that were found to be false witnesses. Of course, we are not to be a false witness to bring harm to someone else. Of course, we should be honest and not tell a lie. But even more so, if we take the principle of this commandment and apply it spiritually into our lives right now, how do we measure up? Are we a true witness or a false witness to God's way of life? Jesus Christ gave us a model, not just of honesty and integrity, but as a witness that we can emulate. His entire life reflected and magnified God's thought process and way of life. He is the ultimate true witness. Let us all continue to strive in God's way of life and demonstrate to the whole world around us that we are striving to be true witnesses ourselves and uphold all facets of the ninth commandment.